This episode of Forensic Forecast is brought to you by Digital Forensics Magazine at www.digitalforensicsmagazine.com and by contributions by our listeners. Thank you all very much. Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast, episode 26. Very happy you could join us. We had a little bit of a break over Christmas, but we're glad to be back. As always, I'm Lee.
And I'm Simon.
And we've got some interesting things to talk about today. And before we get into that, I just want to say that if you stay listening, we're going to talk to a couple of other people about their podcasts. We don't have interviews per se today, but we've got Dave from Inside the Core and Joe Garcia from Cybercrime 101. And they're both going to give us a little bit of insight into their podcasts and how they come up with the ideas and where you can find them if you want to listen to them as well. I say as well because you don't listen to them instead of us, obviously.
Well, of course not.
No, because that would suck for us, really. I could see some people doing it out of spite, but, you know, that's just me. Okay. So I don't think there's anything extremely urgent to talk about, is there?
Not that I'm aware of.
I'll just say this quickly. I have had a couple of people ask about the Forensic Forecast Awards already, and it is January, and we'll make moves on this soon after we've discussed exactly what we want to do about it, because I don't think we're entirely sure ourselves yet what we want to do this year. Last year, obviously, it was a bit of a joke and a bit of a laugh, but I think people have taken it a lot more seriously than it was intended. So, in turn, I think that we're going to have to try and make it a bit more serious this year.
Be serious?
Well, it happens from time to time.
Only when we're venting.
Well, yeah. But I think that, you know, potential to make this into something quite good here. So we're going to have a discussion about it, and we'll figure out what we want to do, and then we'll move on from there. And we're thinking probably a few weeks we'll be ready to talk about that a bit more. Also, the SANS EU Forensic Summit takes place on the 19th and the 20th of April this year. So if you want to sign up for that, you can go to the SANS website and apply there. One good reason to go is that I'll be there speaking, as I've said before. And part of my secret project I've been working on the last few weeks, which is making steady but good progress. I'm hoping I have it done in time. I'm working with Mark McKinnon on it. I'm hoping that we can have it done in time for this presentation. But we shall see. There's so many other things going on, it's ridiculous. Including our new podcast, which we're launching as well, Simon.
Mm.
So, yes, we shall see. We shall see exactly what we want to do here. But, okay, if we move on to some news. And what an interesting couple of months it has been. Because we reported on coffee the last time we spoke on here, and the time before that as well. And lo and behold, someone went out of their way to write a small program called Decaf, which would run on their computer. Then it would basically, if you plugged a USB device which had coffee installed on it, it would detect that and then start doing all kinds of weird and wonderful stuff to your computer and destroy any potential evidence. So that was very kind of that person to do that.
Yeah.
And so there, a few people had questions for this guy, and one of these people was Ovi Carroll from the CyberSpeak podcast. Hi, Ovi, and he gave him quite a grilling. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to that interview, Simon.
I didn't really get round to it.
Oh, I tell you what, I listened to it on the train on the way into work one day, and it starts off with, oh, so yeah, this piece of software, go on, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden, Ovi's like, why did you make this? What's the point in it? There's only one point in this, and that's because that's to thwart law enforcement investigations. And he went on and eventually got to a point where he challenged him and said, will you please take this down? And they did. The very next day, it was gone from the internet. And there was a small, well, there was quite a lengthy posting, actually, up on the website, which is decafme.org. And this posting, not there anymore, it's been removed and something else has been put in its place. But this posting was unusual, to say the least. Now, I know you had a chance to look at that. Bit,
yeah. It seemed like they didn't necessarily know what to put there, so they just did a bit of ranting about every subject that was on the top of their mind at the time.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that they said was that we shouldn't put our trust in automated tools and stuff like that. And yeah, I find it hard to disagree with that, because
I think that's a valid point, but I don't think there really are many people that would. At least I hope there wouldn't be many that would.
Well, now, yeah, you say that, but when you look at what people like Access Data are peddling recently, where, you know, they say stuff like, we're taking complex forensic investigations out of the hands of the experts and putting it into the hands of, you know, the average Joe, that's cause for concern for me. And Mark McKinnon is one of these people who, this is one of the drums he bangs on quite frequently, and rightly so, is that people put their trust in this software to provide results to them, and all that happens essentially is that we become button jockeys. We just say, right, click this, perform this, click this, perform this, without giving any real attention to what is happening underneath.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we should really be in the habit of reporting things using this automated software if we don't know how to do that ourselves.
No, I think you should always know how to, where possible, you should know how to do something yourself, or you should at least know enough about what's going on to be able to coherently explain it to someone. So you can demonstrate that what you've presented or what you've found actually means what you're saying it means.
Yeah, absolutely. It would make sense to do that, wouldn't it? I mean, all the automated tool is there to do, essentially, is to speed things up. Because if you have to do everything by hand using just a regular hex editor, you could be there for a substantial amount of time. The automated tool is there for speed only. And essentially, everything else should be our own personal knowledge. So that's fair enough. That comment, I very much agree with. But then they went on to some crusade about how, I don't know, it was some religious type speak. And I think people got a little bit confused and weirded out by some of that. And we thought that was it then. We thought, well, that's fair enough, that they've made their point and now that's the end of it. There was a few articles published about it as well, almost all of them inaccurate. I don't know how many blogs and how many news articles I commented on where the person had inaccurately reported Decaf as a hoax. And it never was a hoax. It worked.
Yeah.
Worked fine. But people said, oh no, well, it wasn't real software. And it took ages to get anybody to print a retraction. And it's insane. I don't understand why people just don't do their homework and just look at what's going on. They say, oh, well, you know, we got information from here. Well, check your information. But anyway, that's besides the point. But so people wrote about it, and it was pretty much all dead and buried. Until about a couple of weeks ago, lo and behold, you go into the Decaf website, and there's a press release up there. And it says, essentially, they've released Decaf version 2. And what they're going to explain is that Decaf version 1, it was disabled kind of by accident, just because it needed to call home in order to work properly. So I guess if you knocked off the internet connection of a computer, then you could easily use Coffee anyway. But so that was what killed it off originally. And then they've... Oh, I don't know what they're doing. What are they doing?
I don't really know how to explain. I don't think we can really know what they're thinking in doing it, but anti-forensics tools essentially have been around for a while, haven't they? People develop these things and they're around, they gain a reputation.
The thing that gets me, right, is that if you listen to the CyberSpeak interview, this Mike guy, he sounded as if he was very apologetic for the fact that he's possibly disrupted investigations. That he, you know, his main intent was to show that push-button forensics is bad. And what he also talked about was fingerprinting. He said, well, basically, you know, you can fingerprint this software so that you can detect it and stop it from working. And that was essentially just for Microsoft Coffee. But this latest version, rather than being apologetic and thinking, oh, you know, maybe it's time to stop, we've made our point, they've now fingerprinted software tools from the Helix disk for Encase, Passware, Elcomsoft, FTK Imager, the full forensic toolkit, ISO Buster, and Oftcrack. And it also allows people to add their own custom signatures. For example, if you wanted to add something for another piece of software, you could just bung that on there as well. And to me, if your point was to show that these tools could easily be avoided or fingerprinted and, you know, prevent them from running on a machine, then your point's already been made. Why? Why are you bringing out more software?
Yeah, it's not to make a point anymore, is it? It's to make a name for yourself.
Well, they've already made a name for themselves. This is the thing. Is that if you're going to act all apologetic and you're going to write this whole big posting about, you know, this is why we did it, it wasn't meant to cause any harm, etc., etc., and then you immediately start work on the next phase of this, it makes you out to be a liar. It makes you out that you don't care about the things which you originally wrote, the things which you originally said on the interview which you had. And rather than making you look like quite an intelligent person who can provide software like this, you become a laughingstock.
You either look like you're apathetic or you look like you are completely indecisive. I'm not really sure which this guy is.
No. I'm just amazed at this.
Are we sure it's by the same person? He hasn't, like, sold the domain on?
No, it's the same person. That there's two people involved in this project, and it's just... I don't know what they're thinking. I mean, there are ways to counteract it. There always will be for these kinds of tools. I mean, Coffee is first responder software, isn't it? So, I mean, all you got to do, you know, you're going to collect live stuff. But if you're going in for, like, a fraud case or a decent image case or something like that, then the memory doesn't mean as much as it would do in, say, an intrusion case. So, what will tend to happen is that people will still go in, still pull the plug, at which point your decaf is completely useless.
Yep.
Well, not only that, but if people find decaf on your machine, having already imaged it, then it just adds more weight to the argument that you're trying to cover your tracks. It's just you want to grab these people. I sent an email to Ovi when I first heard this, because we'd been talking back and forth about this, and I said, oh, have you seen that version 2 is out? And he just emailed back and said, that's very disappointing. I don't really have much else to say. He must feel rather stunned by it, because he's spoken to this guy on a number of occasions.
Yeah.
But, it's just crazy stuff. I can't wait to see what the next thing is, really. This is almost like a soap opera. I won't be downloading it. I'll go and visit their site and see what the latest news and everything is, but I'm never going to be using the software. And I don't think I'll be paying much attention to what they have to say if they appear at a conference or anything like that either, to be perfectly honest. Loons.
I don't... You wonder if they would dare show their face at some some things, if this tool that they've developed ends up being used to hamper any investigations.
Yeah, well, like I said, there's ways to counteract it and to stop it from being able to interfere. But people are going to have to watch out for it now. But then again, how many people are actually using coffee? How many people are doing the thing? Mm. See, this software can only really be run on the computer when people have got sufficient privileges as well. So if you're talking about an intrusion investigation, again, which is where you're most likely to collect the volatile data, then you're talking usually about a computer inside a company. And that means that somebody will have to have given adequate permissions and authority to install that software on there, which they're not likely to do. So if things are locked down sufficiently inside a company, then they won't be able to run decaf anyway.
No.
Who knows? We shall keep our eye on that one and let people know any further developments.
It's just all a bit of a mess, isn't it, really?
Yes. Okay, so in other news, Into the Boxes is the new digital forensics magazine, which has just had its first issue released. It's available at intotheboxes.wordpress.com, and it's done by Harlan Carvey and Don Weber. I know, having spoken to Harlan quite a lot previously, this is something that he's had in mind for at least a year, possibly two, and something that he's wanted to do for quite some time. So I'm glad to see that he's actually done it. And if you go to intotheboxes.wordpress.com, you can go onto the website there and you can download the PDF for that magazine. And it's pretty good. I really like that. The first article has got... the first edition has got an article by Didier Stevens. It's got an interview with Harlan Carvey. And... you know, Don Weber's written an article in there. It's good stuff, and stuff which I think is going to be very useful to the community. I think it's well worth everyone going and having a little peek and downloading the first issue there. And in true geek fashion, they've called it issue number 0x0. And this thing is a little geeky, but...
Well, what do you expect?
But yeah, it's well worth a read, and they're looking for contributions from other people in the field as well. So if you feel that you've got something interesting to say, go on to the blog, same website, and sign up. Just give them a suggestion, and you never know, you might be in the next issue. So, yeah, that's quite good, that. I like that. The UK government has started an initiative to put computers and broadband into every home. Now,
yay.
This is a tremendous idea. What I can think of better ways to spend £300 million or $500 million.
Yeah, your immediate thoughts might spring to things like possibly reducing national debt or something, but I think that there are merits to this idea. I think it's of course a good thing to aim for, is having children everywhere have access to additional resources at home, so that they can learn more and stuff like that. But what's to say it's going to be used to learn more? Is my skeptical side of things.
Well, yeah, I mean there is that. Obviously, I mean, but your first bit, you are right. I mean, the whole idea for this is so that children can use the computers, can use the internet for assignments they get from school, for homework and whatever else, and they can improve their education. Now, that's all good, all well and good, but these people, like you say, once these kids are in bed, what are the parents going to be using the internet for? And why should we be funding it?
The thing is, it. My understanding these days is that getting some level of broadband connection isn't particularly expensive. I can't imagine there's many homes these days that don't have some kind of home phone line anyway. And so adding broadband access to that is anything from £5 a month or something, but some places not even that.
Yeah.
So you've got to think, people who really decide to do it and who really want internet for the benefit of their children's education will find a way to get hold of it. Maybe that's being a bit unfair, I don't know.
No, I think you are right. I mean, obviously we're getting away from the forensic side of things here and getting more into the politics side, but you got to think not only about the setup cost of this, but then there's the running cost of this as well.
Yeah.
This isn't just a £300 million outlay this year, or whenever they decide to implement it, but then the other running cost each year for each place you've set this up. And
tech support for it could be a nightmare, couldn't it, really?
Yeah. I'm all for everybody having access to the internet. But if you want access to the internet, you pay for it. That's my feeling. I mean,
I can understand that. I mean, when we first got married, we were living on a low income and we were still able to afford a broadband connection and still able to use it for things we needed to use it for. It wasn't expensive. It was, I hunted around and it was the cheapest deal I could find, and it probably wasn't any more than £5 a month. Yeah. But it was a deal that worked. It gave us internet access and gave us the things we needed.
Yep.
And I wonder how many of the people out there would sacrifice a few pounds a month of whatever luxuries they have to be able to afford board, because it's on nearly every budget, I'd have thought.
Yeah. Well, okay, so we're a forensics podcast, so let's talk about the forensic implications of this. Now, they're talking about low-income houses here, or low-income homes. Now, I live in an area which, I've got to admit, isn't the nicest area in the world, okay? There's not very many adults on this street which actually work, who actually work for a living, let's be fair. Now, what that means is that the children in this area, they don't care about education. They don't care about, you know, finding good employment, because they'll do what their parents have done their whole lives and live off handouts from the government. And so what it tends to do is that it pulls areas like this down quite severely. And there's just this underlying criminal element to things. And I think if you start dishing out computers to people who are already involved in, or potentially involved in, this kind of activity, you're going to give them more avenues or more opportunity to, you know, to do bad things.
It's the nature of life, isn't it? That areas that are more deprived see rises in crime rates. It's just the unfortunate way things go. And so you start introducing a free service like broadband into these places. It's another thing for people to use for whatever means they want to use them for. Yeah. But that's not to say that millions of people wouldn't benefit from this idea and wouldn't use it for the right things, but they'll probably be a few who don't, and it's the same with everything, really.
Yeah. No, I realise that. I also think about, like, when the kids go to bed at night, you can just see some dad somewhere using the computer using the computer and the broadband connection that, to our taxes, we have helped to fund to look at porn. I just don't know how comfortable I feel about that, to be honest. Go satisfy your perversions on your own dime. Not on the government's, but who am I, anyway? I'm just...
Well, you'd hope if this was something that was to be introduced that there'd be a way of making sure it's being used for the right things, but how do you enforce that anyway?
The same way they enforce it in schools, perhaps. They're completely ill-equipped to deal with kids because they find ways around the firewalls, they find ways around all the security systems which are in place, all the technology which blocks the stuff. They find ways around it. And we're talking about 7-8-year-old kids. We're not talking about criminal masterminds. And they'll do the same at home, as will their parents. And they'll teach their parents how to do it. So, and then there's always people who'll get the computer and then just sell it on and use the money to buy drugs as well. But I might be generalising slightly by at this point. So we'll move on.
Yeah. Let's see how many other people we can potentially offend in the rest of this podcast.
Oh, we do it every time.
Oh, we do, yeah. We don't really get... I'd say we probably don't get that many complaints, but they wouldn't come to me anyway, so...
We've not had a complaint in a while. I think someone should step up to the plate here.
Yeah. What can we do to try and get another one? We try pretty hard, to be fair.
Yeah. Obviously not hard enough. Okay. Was there a piece of news you wanted to bring up?
I just wanted to discuss briefly something that's really... I've really noticed in the last week or so, it's been around for a while, which is to do with Barclays Bank over here. They've come up with an ingenious way of helping completely eliminate online fraud, so they say, which is to send out to a bunch of people
a little calculator type device. Well, it essentially looks like a calculator. You put your credit or debit card, your bank card into it, type in your PIN number, and it will give you a code that allows you to access the online banking site of theirs. And without that, there's certain things you can't do. You can't transfer, send payments to people and various other things. But I got this and I was quite intrigued, and so I did a bit of digging around just to see what people had found out about it and what people had blogged about it. I discovered that one person had taken this device and had already essentially hacked it so that he could have the code he needed to get into his online bank site sent to him from his PinSentry device via an SMS message, which I thought was quite interesting. Yeah, that's all of a sudden a little bit less secure. Some people pointed out some interesting things, which is if you want to log into your online bank account and do anything, you need this device with you to be able to do it. The code it gives you does not time out. So if someone were to get hold of a code that was generated a week ago, they could still use it to log into an account.
But what if that code's already been used to log in, though?
I don't think it matters. I'm not sure. I haven't checked it into that sort of detail, but maybe I will, for fear of locking myself out of my own account, I suppose. But someone pointed out, yes, if you have someone who, say, carries their cards and their little, what they call a PinSentry device, with them, have it in like a bag or something. If someone mugs this person and takes their bank card, they can hold them at gunpoint, knife point or whatever and say, what's your PIN to the card? And in any normal situation, you might spiel off some sort of random four-digit number until they leave you alone. But in this case, if they find this little device and they know what it means, they can say, okay, you've given me this PIN, now I'll just verify it right in front of you.
Oh, dear.
And another person pointed out...
That's a bit of an extreme example, though.
It's an extreme example. I can't imagine that ever really happening. It would be... it would have to be a very, very on-the-ball mugger to do something like that, I suppose. And someone else pointed out that you enter the incorrect PIN three times and it can lock your bank card. And he said that it's a nice new device he has for locking the bank cards of people he doesn't like. So... this is an interesting device, and it's been around for a few months. It certainly isn't new, but I just thought it was worth mentioning that Barclays are now essentially forcing people to use this device, and I can just see it falling over in a big heap at some point in the future. If people can hack Oyster cards and national ID cards in a matter of seconds or minutes, if someone really put their mind to this, they could potentially crack the system of verifying pins for a chip and PIN card.
Fantastic.
So that's and here's a device they're sending out free to people, or for a minimum charge of about £6. So there you go. You break it in your research, you just order another one.
And that's you're with Barclays then, yes?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I'm glad you could publish that for everyone to hear.
I might not be for much longer.
All right, cool stuff. Okay, so coming up now, we're going to hear from Dave Melvin of Inside the Core, and then Joe Garcia of Cybercrime 101. They're going to tell us a little bit about their podcasts. And when we return, Simon's got an interesting little story for us. All right, we're joined now by Dave Melvin from Inside the Core. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing good, thanks, Lee.
Good stuff. Now, for those people who aren't familiar with you, would you like to just give us a little bit of background about yourself?
Sure. I'm a federal law enforcement officer here in the United States. I have been in law enforcement for about 13 years at the federal level, And for about the past 10, almost 11 now, actually, next month, it'll be 11 years as a criminal investigator. And I've been doing forensics for just about the past 9 years. Most of the cases I work, they're kind of split up now. It used to be primarily child pornography, child exploitation mm-hmm. cases. But also doing some interesting things like transfer of information outside the country, false documents, what we call commercial smuggling, things like that.
Yep. Very cool.
In 2000, well, let me give you a little background on the Mac side. Prior to 2002, I was a Mac hater. I didn't grow up with them. You know, I really didn't start into computers until about 1986 or so with a Tandy. And just couldn't fathom why someone would use a Mac. Well, I was lucky enough in 2002 to go to a Mac forensics course put on by Ryan Chapin in Viridian. And that kind of turned the pages for me. It was how to use a Mac as a forensic platform. But not only that, he taught us how to use it, which I thought was fantastic. And shortly after that, I bought my first Mac laptop, which was an iBook. Found out that wasn't powerful enough, so I got a PowerBook, and the rest is history. Pretty much have about 9 Macs in the house right now. Everything's run by that. you know, some comes out, you know, my pocketbook starts burning. I need another new toy. But really, I don't have a PC in the house. I tossed the last one about 2 years ago. And to pretty much do everything on the Mac. And if I got to go to Windows, I have the virtual machines. I really don't boot into my boot camp anymore. I just use virtual machines because it's a lot easier. Runs a lot faster.
Excellent. So do you still use an iPhone as well then?
Yes, I do. I do. I'm a fanboy. I'm sorry.
Nothing to be sorry about at all. Okay, so it's your love of Macs which driven you essentially to start Inside the Core, I imagine.
Right. Inside the Core kind of came out of several of us getting to know each other through the International Association of Computer Investigative Specialists, or IASIS.
Yep.
Oh, I got my certification with them in 2002, and then I started being a coach and an instructor. And there was only like 2 other Mac guys in the whole group, and that was Steve Whalen and Reggie Chapman. And we struck up a friendship and, you know, talked Mac stuff, started talking about Macs, helping each other with cases, going to Steve, who is really a wealth of information on Mac stuff, and when I needed questions, he'd answer them for me. As time went on, we started teaching the Mac portion of the IASIS basic course, which is usually about an hour block of instruction, and that's when we met Ryan Kabaziak.
Yeah.
And now Chris has come on board. He's also we all met him through IASIS. So there's that core group of Mac guys that kind of get together and you know, talk about Macs and work out problems and do research.
Very cool.
So the you know, just yeah, I guess you could say it was a love of the Mac, but it's also because, you know, there wasn't a lot of Mac information out there.
Yep.
It's funny because, you know, you talk to people a couple of years ago, and when you'd say, "Oh, I got a Mac," they kind of cringe, and you know, well, there's nothing on that computer. Because people didn't know how to look at them. They didn't know what it was. And it's not just a couple of years ago. I'd say it's more like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
People are much more comfortable with them now.
Yeah.
But really, where did you go for information? When I started doing it, there was really only I could call Ryan Chapin, because he's a nice guy. He'd answer my questions. Or I'd go to Derek Donnelly's Mac Forensics forum on Yahoo, which is a great source of information on Mac Forensics. Or I'd call Black Bag. I'd call Ben there or Derek with questions. So there wasn't a lot of information on Macs, and we found that it was probably time to start giving back to the forensic community, because, you know, whenever you have questions, whenever you're not sure what you're doing or run into something new, you always reach out to a listserv or to a group of friends, and you're always able to get information fairly quickly. Well, we wanted to do the same thing. So that's kind of how Inside the Core came about. That along with Ryan's website, or our website, which is macOSXForensics.com.
Yep. So why the podcast? Why did you think, you know, what made you think that a podcast specifically would be a good idea as opposed to some other type of media?
Well, you know, I think because it's easy to get the information out that way. Maybe not the work that it takes to put one together, but actually, you know, because what do I do with podcasts now? I'm in the lab. I'm sitting at my workstation. I put on headphones. I get into my groove and I listen to CyberSpeak or listen to Forensic Forecast or something. And I can just, you know, take in that information and listen while I'm working.
Yep.
So why not have that available on Mac stuff? There really wasn't that much Mac stuff out there. And we try to keep it a little bit light, a little bit lively. But we also want to get that key information out there. And this is a great way, we think, to get it out very quickly and very easily.
Excellent stuff. What do you find is some of the challenges when it relates to producing a podcast?
You know, there's plenty of information, so that's not it. Because you can just, you know, open up your Mac and grab a plist and you have, you know, 10, 20 minutes to talk about on a show.
Yep.
I think the hardest part is getting everybody together and then the post-production. I think that's probably the hardest thing. But luckily we have a good crew. Right now it's Chris and I. Ryan's in and out because of some prior commitments.
Yep.
But we all work well together. We take care of different parts of the podcast, and that makes it a little bit more smoother.
Yeah.
But I think really getting everybody together is probably the hardest because we're so busy.
I think me personally, I like to draw a parallel that doing a podcast is a bit like doing digital forensics. Is that the exciting bit is actually doing the work, like recording or doing the investigation, and then doing the post-production is more like doing the report side of things. It's not as not as interesting and a bit more
dull. I think
dull.
You hit it on the head of the nail there. That's exactly it, because I don't know how many times I'll listen to a podcast till I think it's good enough. And then I'll put it out, and then I'll get slammed for some sound quality.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we've all been there. All right, so
we're learning.
So, I mean, we know that Inside the Core is largely Mac-based, but is there anything specifically that you discuss on the show? Like, do you have specific segments and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think probably one of our favorite ones is the plist of the week, or we call it Plow.
Mm-hmm.
And basically a plist is, to equate it to Windows, is a registry.
Yeah.
Okay, obviously there's no single registry on the Mac, which makes it a bit more stable, I think. But they have individual configuration files called property lists. And there's so much information in these property lists that they can actually be your smoking gun. And that's the fun part, is going onto a system and finding one and then doing the research on it and then presenting it on the show. We try to do a lot of things. Sometimes we'll do a show all on one subject. What I like to do is I like to have different topics. Okay, each one of us will do a different topic, and that kind of gives it some variety. So it's not, you know, you're listening to Ryan, myself, and Chris talking about the same thing. I think it helps the show. It exposes the listener to a lot of different things in that short amount of time.
Yeah,
we'll also talk about some fun stuff. We'll talk about website of the week. Not always something to do with forensics, but maybe something that might help out. That's not exactly related to forensics, or something just fun, just a nice website to go out there and laugh at.
Yeah.
You know, of course, Mac-based. you know, but what we talk about, you know, the show being Mac-based, it's all about Macs, but we will talk about how what we present will be equated to the Windows side of forensics, because some people don't have a Mac to do analysis. Come on, they are expensive. Okay, there's no doubt. But what we'd like to do is, when we're talking about these things, we'll say, you know, what you can use on the Windows side as a tool to look at plist, or if you're looking at InCase, what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure that not, you know, we're not alienating people that don't have Macs to do forensics. Though as we'll harp and harp and harp, you know, if you're going to do a Mac, you have to at least do some of it, of the analysis on a Mac itself, because the Windows tools right now, maybe except for FTK 3, which I haven't really played with yet, they really don't present that native viewing of the files. So I really think it's important to either restore the disk and boot it, or to create a DD of it and mount it locked down so that you can go live on the right protected disk image.
Yeah, I've always been told that the best way to investigate a Mac is to have a Mac to do the investigation with. And from what you're saying, that sounds pretty much spot on.
It is. I think it is. I just don't think that right now anything really does justice to the file system on the Windows side. I know, you know, we had an interview with Joe Duke of Access Data, and he talked about FTK3 and what its capabilities, and man, it has come a long way.
Yeah,
it's incredible. I have to install it and I have to get it all working right, which hopefully will be easy. But I think that's probably right now the only Windows side tool that does the Mac forensics justice. Encase can do it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. I use Encase every day, and I will do on my cases. I will do the Mac analysis on the Mac, and I also do my analysis in Windows using Encase, and hopefully pretty soon FTK. So I do, I guess I should say, go both ways, you know, because you have to. That's the way it is.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so if people want to listen to the podcast, where can they go to listen to it? Where can they find you?
They can find us in the iTunes store. Just do a search through iTunes for Inside the Core. They can go to our Mac OS X Forensics website, which is macosxforensics.com, or they can go to insidethecore.com, and we have a link there to the podcast. And it's available both in a MP3 format and an enhanced iTunes format. So in the enhanced format is if you watch it on using iTunes or an iPod or an iPhone, you'll actually see images pop up and links. So say we're talking about forecasts on the show like we have, I'll have a link to your site that they can click on, and it will take them there.
Very cool. All right. And is there can people follow the show on Twitter?
Yes, we do. Thank you. We do have a Twitter, which is at Inside the Core. I probably don't, you know, tweet as often as I should, but I do try to throw, you know, not just forensic stuff on there or announcements that the new episodes are out. But I will do when I see some good things like discounted software or special software groupings that are being sold for fairly cheap. Anything I think is interesting that I'll throw out there on a tweet.
Very cool. Lastly, I mean, I listen to Inside the Core quite a lot, so I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
the music on it, where's the music from?
Oh, that music's great. It's a one-man band called Brad Sucks.
I got a brother called Brad.
Well, okay. So
makes it a bit more funny.
I believe it's bradsucks.net. And he's a one-man band, and he has this this album, the song that we use, which is called Dirtbag. And it just kind of fit all of us, and we all liked it, and that was history.
Very cool.
He's got some great music, though. If you get a chance, check him out. It's Brad Sucks.
I'll have to check that out. All right. Well, thank you for your time today. Very much appreciate it. Hopefully, people will an old-fashioned word, tune in and listen to your podcast.
Thank you very much, Lee. I appreciate you having us on the show.
No problem. Okay, so joining us now is Joe Garcia from Cybercrime 101. How are you doing, Joe?
Good, thank you, Lee. Thank you for having me on.
Good, good. And for those people who are not familiar with you, or perhaps are not yet familiar with your podcast, and we're hoping they will be soon, do you want to give us a brief overview of that?
Sure. My show is Cybercrime 101. I try to do it on a semi-regular basis, and the point behind the show is I'm looking to cover cybercrime news, stuff about computer forensics, information security, and eventually even some tech news when there's some new tech that comes out. And I try to give people some background on how to protect themselves while they're on the internet also.
Did you find it a bit difficult? I mean, with Simon and I, for example, we talk to each other and we bounce things off each other. Well, I mean, for the most part, I mean, Simon doesn't talk for a lot of times, but Do you find it a bit difficult just talking yourself into the microphone all the time?
Sometimes I do. It's hard. I kind of write a script, but I'd say it's more of an outline than a script, and I try to stick to it because I don't have anybody to bounce off of. I found myself a few times, even though I've put out four shows already to this point, I find myself re-recording things over and over again because I just don't like the way it sounds. And sometimes not having somebody to bounce off of, it can be tough, but for the time being, that's the way I'm going to run with it.
Yeah. I guess it has its advantages and disadvantages, doesn't it? Because if, for example, you've recorded everything, you listen back to it and you think, I'd like to change that, it's easy to go back and change it if it's just you recording, whereas if you had a group of people.
Right, and the other part that's good about recording on your own is I really don't have to worry about anybody else's schedule. So if I come home from work late one night, and if I want to and it's midnight and I'm awake, I could start recording something. I don't have to worry about getting together. But like I said, it's sometimes that natural conversation between two people that can make it difficult not having that factor present.
Okay, cool. So what you said, you've done four episodes already. What have been the topics of those four episodes so far?
So far, I've done some Firefox extensions, you know, stuff that would help people be safe. Stuff like AdBlock or NoScript, long URL please, which helps expand out those password shorteners that have been out. I've covered phishing, identity theft. And that's it. You know, basically that's what I've done so far up to this point. And I have some future stuff planned where I'm going to be covering online safety for kids in some future episodes. I'm still working on them. And also in addition to that, I'm going to do a show on specifically for parents, what they need to know to see all the different signs that their kids are doing, the things that their kids are involved with, and to maybe raise their awareness up and how to keep their kids from getting in trouble online.
Ah, fantastic. I think that's definitely a topic that needs addressing a lot more frequently. But where'd you come up with the ideas then? Are the things which you personally have been affected by or know people who have been affected by, or do you tend to go for the more general view?
Both. Basically, I'm a law enforcement officer. I have 15 years of experience. And for the last 3 years, I've been doing cybercrime investigations, and now I'm doing computer forensics. So it's stuff that I've come across on an everyday basis somewhere along the way during my time as a police officer and a detective. And it's the stuff that always keeps to recycle itself. I mean, there's always kids that are either getting into trouble online, or they're being bullied online, or even being taken advantage of by pedophiles. So that stuff just comes natural. It's always going to be a reoccurring theme. And also identity theft is also a reoccurring theme, and, you know, spam and 419 scams. So we'll always have some sort of topic to discuss.
Very interesting. You just said, I just want to just go back and just pick up on something you just said there, is that you worked doing cybercrime investigations, and now you've moved on to computer investigations.
Yeah.
Can you just make a definition of what the difference is between the two?
Yeah, there? So basically for the last 3 years, I had done computer crime investigations where it involved pedophiles, possession of child pornography, some network intrusion cases, some insider theft cases, and a lot of high-end fraud. And now I was just assigned recently to do computer forensics. So far I'm liking it. It's different, you know, not as much on the street or running around doing investigations that way. But computer forensics are just another aspect of an investigation. I still feel like I put my detective skills to work while I'm, you know, going through somebody's hard drive, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people say that, for my personal feeling and opinion on this as well, is that if you pull in somebody from a law enforcement background and put them in front of a computer to do forensics, that they bring one set of skills, but perhaps a short-handed, or whatever you want to call it, on the computer side, on the geeky nature of things, whereas you bring in a geek to do the investigations, they know all of the techie stuff, but perhaps don't have any skill in the investigation side. So do you feel like you're quite amply equipped in both these areas then?
Yeah, I mean, to give you an example, I believe the first computer that my parents ever bought me was an Atari 800 back in 1980. So, I mean, I've been into computers for a really long time. I'm not as schooled as some people are, but I've always had that geek, you know, nature to me where, you know, I've always liked poking around in it. And I feel that that gives me a definite edge over, let's just say, maybe a patrolman or a detective who really doesn't have any computer skills whatsoever. Yeah. And they're just coming in cold trying to learn computers. I at least have a basis in computers before I even came to my unit. I've gotten training since, you know, we go to different types of training with the NW3C here in the States. We've gotten some guidance training, some FTK, some training with the Secret Service and with other government agencies. But I feel that my natural computer geek background has helped me understand this stuff a lot more. This is just stuff that on a normal basis, especially with the forensics, just normal people aren't doing this on an everyday basis. So having that background in computers really gives me an advantage than just hiring a regular detective that really has no background in computers whatsoever.
Yep. Fun stuff. All right, just going back to Cybercrime 101 for a minute. What made you come up with it in the first place?
Well, one of the guys that I work with and I actually, he had the idea for a show. It was called Cybercrime Show. And we did a, I think it was 3 or 4 episodes. I'm trying to remember now. It's a while back, but we started doing it. And originally it was supposed to be 2 or 3 of us sitting around chatting about some of the current state of cybercrime. And it turned out that it was really hard to work into our schedules because, you know, we all work these crazy hours and who gets stuck working late one night, who's coming in early the next day. And even with technology like Skype or iChat, it was just hard to get everybody together. And we started doing solo recorded shows. And this is the first time I'd ever tried podcasting at all. And I kind of got bit by the bug and I really enjoyed it. And what happened was my partner ended up getting involved in life. You know, life kind of took over for him and he got really busy and it just wasn't conducive for him anymore to do it. So I decided to just come up with my own show. It's kind of in the same vein with, you know, covering aspects of cybercrime, but I went and I got all my own, you know, I called it Cybercrime 101 instead of Cybercrime Show. And this way I was in control of everything. I didn't have to worry about asking for passwords for any websites or Skype or whatever it was. So this is all completely mine at this point.
Good stuff. So how are you finding the whole podcasting side of things?
Now it's not so bad. In the beginning, it was a little rough because I hadn't looked into it too much before I started, you know, just getting, you know, accounts set up and setting up a website and, you know, making sure that I had an email, a Skype account and, you know, just, you know, YouTube channel set up. Now I have, you know, now that the iPhone 3GS has the Ustream broadcaster, I even set up an account for that now, just in case I decide to record something. So that was probably the roughest part. Once you have all that other stuff set up, there's so much news and just topics out there on a daily basis when it comes to computers, because as you know, Lee, everything changes on a daily basis with computers. Huh. So it's easy to always have some sort of topic to cover. So, I'm not going to find a lack of information to keep me going, I don't think.
All right. What about people who are thinking about doing a podcast in this particular field? What advice would you give to them having just recently started yourself?
Don't do it because I don't want any competition whatsoever. No, I'm like kidding. Listen, I'm not the expert. The reason I like doing this is because I feel like I'm giving back to the community in general. I guess that's what most people that are into, whether it be InfoSec or computer forensics, I mean, alone, I'm always amazed at the amount of help that I get on Twitter if I have a question, or how much I can help somebody out. So I just want to be able to give stuff back. So if somebody wanted to do this, just make sure that you had the time to do it. Because if you get involved, you get people following you. People are going to be interested. You know, you don't want to start, do one or two shows. Make sure that you can commit to it. That's what I have to say, is just make sure that you have the commitment to do it. Because people will follow you, and they'll ask you questions, and they'll be interested in what you have to say.
Okay. And what about equipment-wise? What are you using to record with? Don't be ashamed, because trust me, I mean, the setup I've got here is pretty dire.
No, I'm actually not ashamed of it. I'm running off my MacBook Pro, and I use GarageBand for most of it. And I went out and actually bought myself a Blue Snowball microphone from Amazon. I think it cost me $60 at the time, US. And it's a nice microphone. I was actually originally, if you listen to like the first three episodes, episode zero through two, I was using just the microphone that came out on the MacBook Pro. And it sounded okay, but I always felt that I had to sit too close to it. I wasn't very comfortable. Now with the Snowball, I could sit back a little bit at a normal, you know, seating height. Like, I don't feel like I'm lurching over the computer now. And I could kind of relax a bit. So, but yeah, you know, it's modest. And eventually, you know, maybe if things take off and it gets that much more popular, maybe I'll invest in a whole, you know, mixing board and all that and get really into it. But for now, this is working, the setup that I have. You can find me out on iTunes by doing a search for Cybercrime 101. I have an email set up. It's cybercrime101@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter, Cybercrime101. It's a repetitive theme, right, Lee? you can check out the website. It's www.cybercrime101.com. And, you know, if anybody has any suggestions, a topic that they'd like to see covered, please, you know, just reach out and email me, or do a comment on the website, or get me on Twitter, send me a direct message, or just a reply in general. I'll be more than happy. If it's a topic that I don't know much about, I'll look up, you know, I'll look up information on it, and I'll try to cover it.
Do you find that people give you a lot of feedback about the show?
I'm actually getting more now. In the very beginning, I wasn't getting much. But I've actually had a few people make some suggestions, and one of them was cyberbullying, somebody mentioned to me. So that's why I decided it's probably either going to be a two or a three episode coverage on just online safety for kids in general, cyberbullying, and then, like I said before, just tips for parents, you know, how to really just help keep on top of their kids and make sure that they're not getting themselves into trouble.
Very cool. I think that one of the good things that you're doing is that Cyberspeak and Forensic Forecast is aimed very specifically at people who are already in the field. So, but I think that Cybercrime 101 has got such a much broader appeal, because it's not just focusing on this tiny little narrow field. It's going out and it's trying to educate people.
Yeah, I wanted to do that because I feel for as much as eventually I'm going to cover computer forensics, and as much as I'm going to cover a little bit of information security, there's already a great number of podcasts for both. You know, you're one of them for the forensics, and Cyberspeak is another one. Inside the Core is great for the Mac forensics. I mean, that's a real niche, but as we know, Macs, with their becoming more popular, guess what? Forensics investigators like you and myself are going to see a lot more of them. And, you know, on the information security side of things, great shows like SecureBit, Exotic Liability, Security Justice, Paul.com. So I want to try to make it where it's toned down a bit. It's maybe not as technical, but it'll still keep the people with, you know, with a strong interest in this stuff, who understand it, interested, and also bring in some novice computer users, just maybe give them a better understanding of how things work with that. So I'm trying to reach out to everybody.
Fantastic. No, I think it's incredibly good what you're doing over there, and hopefully we can send more people your way to have a listen.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Lee.
Yeah, no problems. Okay, hope that was interesting to you, and hope you go and try out those podcasts, Inside the Core brilliant podcast. I've listened to that for quite a while now. Well, since it started, really. And Cybercrime 101, Joe's been doing that for just, you know, a couple of months. But already it's making quite a significant impact. Well worth a listen. Okay, Simon, have you got our funny little story to end with this week?
I do. I have. It is. It's not really forensics related, but it's police related. Okay. Of all the things you could name that you might find around a police station in the middle of London, what might you think of? Let's make it more specific. What might you find on a police officer's desk?
Files.
Okay.
Maybe a computer.
Yep.
Half-eaten sandwiches.
Yeah, probably.
Half-eaten box of donuts.
Yeah, let's get the stereotype in. One thing you might not necessarily expect to find is a mouse nest.
Oh, what?
Yep. Pest controllers were called to an office in Kennington, used by the Metropolitan Police, because there were reports of mice being everywhere. They found that a family of mice had set up home in a pile of paperwork on one police worker's messy desk.
Oh.
Reports the Daily Telegraph. So, there you go. You wonder whether cases are ever filed and just sort of left on the policeman's desk ever.
How long must that have been there for in order for that to happen?
I have no idea. It must have had to have been there a while.
That is quite disgusting.
It's interesting, isn't it, that can happen. I wonder if they have a clear desk policy in that place. They
probably do now.
Yeah.
I always thought it was my desk. It was my my chair that was squeaking, but apparently not. No.
In this person's defence, it wasn't cases that had built up. They said that the paperwork did not relate to operational police matters, which would kind of make the question as to what was it doing there. One officer said some of the desks were so messy it was a wonder anyone could find anything.
Yes, well, that's hardly surprising. I've seen your desk.
So. That's unfair.
It is, but what am I ever fair? Let's face it.
That's true.
Oh, that is quite disgusting. Yeah, I think I probably would find somewhere else to work if that was the case, to be honest. That's really, really disgusting.
I would just, I don't know, there are ways of dealing with it, but possibly in a more comical manner. You just, when this person goes away for the desk, from the office for the day, before they come back in the next day, he just have a nice circle of mouse chaps going right round his desk.
He could play whack-a-mole during his lunch hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening this week. Hope I didn't make you feel sick with that last story, but, you know.
I aim to please.
Yeah.
Sadly, I always miss the mark.
Ever so slightly. We're going to record the first episode of our new podcast, Abort, within the next few days. And I don't know if I spoke about this last time or not. But essentially, it's going to be a collection of stories, such as the one that Simon's just told us, given by different panel members. Each week, and then they'll vote, or there'll be a vote on which one is the best one, and then the person wins essentially the contest for that week. And we're going to ask for people to be guests on that show, and if people want to get involved, then feel free. Just drop us a line here. You can also, let's see, you can follow Forensic Forecast and Abort both on Twitter. So that's at Forecast and at Abort. And Abort, because I don't ever like to do anything conventionally, is AB0RT.
So it just has to have a digit in there somewhere, doesn't it?
It's geeky and it's cool. Well, it's geeky. And I've registered the domain name abort.com, again with the zero instead of the O. But no website there at this very moment, but I'm working on that. Also, visit the Forensic Forecast website. If you've got any comments, please feel free to leave them on there, or you can email Lee or Simon at forensicforecast.com and drop us any ideas or anything you have about the show, and we'll be happy to take them under consideration.
Yep.
All right. Well, once again, thanks for listening. Hope you found it as entertaining as always, hopefully more, and we'll catch you next time. Take care.
Bye.